to be slaughtered when the next death time comes. Once, long ages ago, Durham said wistfully, the folk and strangers covered this world with villages, mighty villages with buildings that reached toward the sky. There were many of us then, more than can be counted. More mythology, Brad wondered, or am I getting a history lesson? Durham continued, the Sky Masters became angry. They destroyed the villages and killed almost everyone. They made the long winters and sent the monsters from Beta that killed those who live today. The Sky Masters? Who are they? Masters of us all. They rule the world. Where are they? Everywhere. But I've never seen them. Neither have I. They are invisible, of course, but they see us. They watch us. They allow us to live, but only if we obey their rules. If we try to break their rules, they will destroy us forever. Brad closed his eyes for a moment. That's some religion you've got. But as he stared at Durham, standing beside him, he thought the gamin looked forlorn, utterly sad, defeated. That evening, back in his shelter, Brad called Kossoff and Littlejohn. As usual, they were in Kossoff's office, waiting for Brad's call. You heard my conversation with Durham? He asked. As he waited for their response, Brad picked up the laser pistol. The thermionic nuclear power pack in its grip was good for several hundred shots, depending on what power level he used. That ought to give me some chance against those cats, he told himself. Interesting mythology, Littlejohn replied at last. Smiling tolerantly, he answered, it always astounds me how complex and detailed mythological tiles can be. That's because they don't have to deal with facts, Kossoff said. No, Brad answered, even before he realized he had spoken. Mythologies deal with facts. They're attempts to understand the facts of the world that the mythmakers live in. Attempts to make some sense out of conditions that are beyond the scope of the culture's knowledge. When they run out of facts, they make up stories that fill in the blanks of their understanding. As he waited for their reply, Brad began to wonder if there was some way to help the gamins. Some way to show them that they didn't have to die. At last, Littlejohn said, good for you, Brad. You've grasped the essence of mythological storytelling. Kossoff interjected, but that doesn't mean those aliens' tale about their death time is scientifically valid. Doesn't it? Brad asked himself. Argument. Some of the time I'm so sure I'm right that I could scream at Kossoff and Littlejohn for being so blind, Brad was telling Felicia. Then I wonder if I'm the one who's blind. Or at least pig-headed. It was late night. Brad was squatting in his shelter talking with his wife, while the wind outside gusted fitfully. At last Felicia answered, I've spoken with Captain Desai. He says it would be possible for you to leave Gamma and get to us at Alpha in the next shuttlecraft, but you'll have to leave in the next day or so before the atmosphere becomes too turbulent for the shuttlecraft to fly through it safely. I'm not leaving. Brad's own words surprised him. Something deep inside him wanted to leave, to get away, to return to Felicia and safety. But another emotion, deeper, stronger, was making him stay. I'm not going to leave them alone, to die, to be wiped out. I'm not going to repeat Dathonium, he told himself. Once she heard his words, Felicia's eyes widened with fright. Brad, you've got to get away. You've got to. You can't stay there and die. I'll be all right, he insisted, trying to put on a smile. Holding up his pistol, he said, I can defend myself. They argued for nearly an hour, a strange kind of quarrel, with 3-minute gaps punctuating their interchanges. For once, Brad was grateful for the time lag. It gave him a chance to calm down, to control his rising temper, to deal with his fears. He saw that Felicia was terrified. Brad, she begged, for me, for my sake, leave the damned planet and come back to me. I can't, Phil, he replied, practically begging. I just can't run away. Can't you see that? In the 3 minutes before her next message, Felicia seemed to change, as if she'd taken a deep breath and decided that further attempts to convince him would be fruitless, barren. All right, she said at last, flatly, coldly. "If that's the way you want it, that's the way it's got to be," Brad said. "Good night, then." It almost sounded like goodbye. "Wait," he called. "You haven't told me what you're doing. How's everything going with your study of the octopods?" Again he waited, wondering if she would answer him at all. "Oh, that's going along pretty well. We've established that MC's estimation of how they survive Mithra's flares is pretty accurate, but unless we shield the planet, they won't be able to survive the death wave by diving deeper into the ocean." It's as if she's delivering a lecture, Brad thought, to a stranger. Felicia went on without hesitating. "According to our calculations, the octopods can go deep enough to avoid being killed by the gamma radiation, but the fish and other sea creatures that they feed on can't. When the octopods return to their normal levels, they'll find a desert waste. No food. They'll starve to death. All of them." "Unless we provide the shielding to protect the planet," Brad said. Slightly more than 3 minutes later, Felicia nodded, poker-faced. "Yes. Unless we provide the necessary shielding."
"Which will also protect them from having the atmosphere and ocean boiled away."
"Yes," said Felicia, as flatly as one of MC's responses.
"Phil, I've got to stay here," he blurted. "You can see that, can't you?"
At last she replied, "I can see that you need to stay. More than you need to return to me." Brad stared at the display screen, stunned by her answer. Abruptly, the screen went blank.
"She's cut the connection," Brad realized. "She's cut me off."
It never occurred to him that she might have cut the connection because she didn't want him to see her crying. Brad couldn't sleep. He tossed fitfully in his bedroll, his mind filled with his last glimpse of Felicia's face. She looked hard, angered, disappointed, cold. "I've hurt her," he realized. "She's hurt because I need to stay here more than I want to return to her. I've hurt her," he told himself over and over again. "Maybe I've lost her." He squeezed his eyes shut and tried to force himself to sleep. No use. Sitting up, he realized it's probably a good thing. Sleep brings dreams, and he didn't want to face the dream again. Not tonight. I wouldn't be able to deal with it. "Is that why I'm staying?" he wondered. "Am I trying to atone for Tithonium? Trying to prove that I'm not a coward?" With a shake of his head, he told himself, "No. There's more to it than that. I'm going to help Nx and the others. Help them get through their death time. Show them how to survive." Outside his shelter, the wind suddenly rose to a piercing shriek. In the darkness, Brad felt the shelter shake. Something flashed out there, a bright streak of lightning. A heartbeat later, thunder exploded, like a bomb going off. Brad heard rain pelting down on his shelter, hard, insistent. "It's okay," he told himself. "This shelter can withstand hurricane-force winds, that's what the manual said." But he felt the shelter shaking, trembling under the lashing of the rain, like a man being pummeled by a giant. "It'll be okay," he told himself. "The shelter's hurricane-proof." And then he laughed out loud. "I couldn't get to the shuttlecraft in this storm," he realized. "I couldn't start back to Felicia, even if I wanted to." And he wanted to. At this particular moment, battered by the lashing rain, terrified by the shrieking wind, he wanted to be safe and warm in Felicia's arms. Something thumped in the darkness. "Must be the lamp," Brad thought. "It's fallen over. I ought to find it, turn it on. It's stupid to sit here in the dark." But before he could get to his knees, the whole shelter lurched and swayed. Brad heard water gurgling outside its thin walls. The shelter moved, like an air car gliding across the sands of Mars. Brad toppled sideways in the darkness, while the shelter slid downhill like a canoe careening along a raging stream. Starship Odysseus. Felicia woke the next morning, dry-eyed and mournful. "He's left me," she thought. Then she said aloud, "No, he's staying on Gamma to deal with his own demons. He's fighting a battle that I can't help him with. There's nothing I can do to help him." And despite herself, she broke into tears. At the biolab that morning, Felicia tried to bury herself in the latest observations of the octopods.
They were swimming through Alpha's planet-wide ocean, totally oblivious to the death that was hurtling toward them with the speed of light, blissfully unaware that their world was about to be devastated. Unless we help them. Unless we sink a half-dozen generators into their ocean to produce the energy screen that will shield their world from the death wave. And the stupid octopods won't even know that we've helped them, saved them from obliteration. They'll just keep on cruising through their ocean as if nothing has happened. Apes and angels, she thought. Which are they? Too stupid to understand what's approaching them, or too lofty to care? Maybe they sense, somehow, that we'll take care of them, protect them, save them. And who's going to take care of Brad? Protect him, save him. She wanted to tell herself that Brad was committing suicide, deliberately letting himself die on a strange world, preferring to die alone down there with the aliens instead of coming to safety, coming to me. Brad's inner demons are killing him, and there's nothing I can do about it. She held back the tears. Not here, not in a lab where everybody can see me. I've got to be strong, even if there's nothing I can do to save him. Although she had no appetite, Felicia forced herself to go to the cafeteria at lunchtime. Don't stay alone, she told herself. Be with others. Try to be normal. She took a tray and picked a meager salad and a glass of iced tea, then scanned the busy, noisy cafeteria for a table. Gregory Nyerere was sitting alone at a table for four. Felicia headed there. The muscular linguist looked up from his bowl of stew and smiled at her as Felicia placed her tray on the table. How are you? He asked in his high-pitched voice. I don't see much of you these days. I'm pretty busy, Felicia replied. Studying the octopods, you know. Anything new from them? She shook her head. Same old, same old. Nyerere took a spoonful of stew. Then, how's Brad doing? I hear conditions on Gamma are getting pretty hairy. Yes, Felicia said. Pretty hairy. Nyerere studied her for a long moment. Well, if you need a shoulder to cry on, I'm here for you. Am I that obvious? You look wound pretty tight. He's all alone out there, Felicia burst. There's nobody to help him. He'll be all right. He's going to get himself killed. Why doesn't he come back? Won't his shuttlecraft make it back here? He could if he wanted to. And he doesn't want to? Nyerere asked, his expression incredulous. No, he doesn't. Doesn't want to come back to you? By God, I would. Felicia tried to smile, failed. Nyerere reached out and touched her shoulder. It must be awful, being all alone. He's with the Gammons. Not him, you. Felicia stammered. I'm all right, Greg. His grip on her shoulder tightened slightly. No, you're not all right. You're in pain. I can feel it. Mind if I join you? They looked up. Felicia saw James Littlejohn holding a loaded lunch tray in both hands. Before Nyerere could reply, Felicia said, Yes, please, sit down. The Aborigine put his tray down and pulled out a chair. I just heard from Brad, he said almost cheerfully. The weather's picking up on Gamma. His shelter slid down the hillside he was camped on. Rainwater turned the ground into a minor river. Felicia gasped, Is he hurt? No, no, Little John answered. Just shaken up a little. He's fine. Nyerere said, Conditions on Gamma are going to get worse before they get better.